and welcome to Mormon Sex Info. This is Natasha Helfer-Parker, and I am thrilled to have two very well-known speakers and authors today on my show. I have Douglas Braun Harvey and Michael Vigorito. They are the authors of a fairly new book, came out called Treating Out of Control Sexual Behavior, Rethinking Sex Addiction. And this has really made some very strong waves in the sex therapy world as far as having a very applicable approach and well thought out approach to some of these issues that we've been talking about for a lot of my podcasts and other podcasts and just kind of in general in the public. So welcome to the show, Doug and Michael. So glad to have you. It's just a huge honor to have you on.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, it's wonderful. And I actually had a chance to see you both in action in Puerto Rico this summer at the ASEC conference and went to your presentation and loved it. And I think, Michael, you and I actually went into the jungle together, so that was exciting.
Yes, we did. Explored the rainforest together.
Right. Okay. So why don't I just give you a chance to, first of all, introduce yourselves a little bit more in depth, tell us a little bit about your backgrounds, and maybe some concepts about how the two of you even started working together.
I've been a therapist since the early 1980s, so that might help the listeners get a little sense of how long I've been at this.
This is Doug talking.
This is Doug, and I'm a marriage and family therapist, a certified group therapist, and a certified sex therapist. So those are all specializations and degrees that I've sort of acquired for the last several decades. And it was in the early 90s that I began to what eventually has led to this specialization, only because in San Diego there was an underground vice police operation where attractive police officers would pose in places where men might be known to have sex with men and would arrest men in a trapped situation. And it was humiliating, degrading, and horrible for these men to go through this law enforcement experience. And then when they were arrested, they were required to go to a sex addiction treatment program in which sex offenders were also in the room. So a man who might have been engaged in some sort of public sex with another man was court-ordered as part of the consequence of this behavior to sit in a group for an extended period of time with men who had been arrested and tried and convicted of sex offenses. And this was a really horrible experience. And so I saw it as a social justice issue, and I worked with the courts to allow therapy with me to meet the same eligibility completion of their court requirements rather than have to go and sit in a group of sex offenders. And as I began to work with these men, I began to see that there was a separate group of these men who had some significant problems regulating their sexual behavior. And that's how I became interested in the behavior and the concerns. And then I looked into the sex addiction model back in the mid-90s and got a lot of training in it and actually found it to be a model I didn't agree with, and have been working on sort of finding alternative ways of thinking about this behavior ever since. And I'll let Michael kind of introduce himself, because then he can kind of talk about how he came into us working together and how we got to here.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that kind of leads us right into the book. This is Michael. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified group psychotherapist in D.C., but I've only been out here for a few years. I did a lot of my clinical training in San Diego, where I was starting to work in HIV mental health, also a kind of a social justice issue, trying to help provide mental health treatment to a vulnerable and stigmatized population. And then within that clinic, I was finding that there was a subgroup of clients who, despite having a pretty significant consequence of their sexual behavior, becoming infected with HIV, were still reporting that they were having trouble with sexual self-control. So I was a newer clinician, so I went into the literature, I was trying to figure out what was going on, and since sex addiction was the predominant lens to which we evaluated this behavior, I was first exposed to that, and it seemed to overly pathologize unconventional sexual interests or gay men who are struggling with coming out. So that propelled me to look for a different approach. So Doug had been doing this work in San Diego, so I approached him for some training on how to work with this population. And then in that training and kind of in kind of how I think and work and kind of writing things down and kind of challenging Doug on a couple things and trying to like explain to me how this works and where's the science behind this. And it ended up being a pretty dynamic experience. So by the time our training period was ended, we had this protocol, kind of this outline of our work that ended up being the beginnings of the outline for this book. And so we continued to work together where we started co-treating and running groups together, presenting on our ideas, kind of refining our approach, going to present at sex therapy conferences, counseling conferences. I think over the course of 8 years, then we finally felt that our approach was finished enough, and that became the outline for the current book.
And so I don't necessarily want to make this about the sex addiction model treatment, but since you both seem to have had some experience with that, can we spend just a few minutes as to why you didn't agree with that model and the problems that you saw with that approach?
I think first and foremost was that as I traveled between the worlds of sex therapy, sex research, and sex education, and then also traveled in the worlds of sex addiction, clinical training, and conferences, I was struck by the absence of current and trained sex educators and sex therapists in the field of sex addiction. It was as if the two worlds didn't know about each other. And it was striking to see this entire world of sex addiction therapy develop without integrating the current knowledge and advances in sex research and sex therapy that were happening from the 1980s to current. And it's pretty much remained that way. That was really the biggest concern for mine. I did not see the clinical model or the ways of working with the behavior as being developed by or implemented by researchers and clinicians who were steeped in training and understanding of human sexual behavior.
So one of the concerns I have is using a phrase that has a diagnostic language. So currently there's no clinical disorder that's officially recognized for sexual behavior problem. But some of the language that we use implies a disorder or etiology, like sex addiction or sexual compulsivity. So partly my concern was it was the impact of introducing a disease model as someone is trying to understand and regain some type of sexual control, particularly one that hasn't been established by the research or by a consensus in the field. And I don't think that is a benign choice that can have a particular consequence. And I think there's an ethical question around when, as clinicians, we introduce that type of language. So I wanted to find a different approach that is kind of more health behavior promoting rather than an approach that was disease oriented or trying to ameliorate a disease, and particularly one that hasn't yet been established in the literature.
I would add to that, Michael, that you and I have talked about this a lot. There may at some point become enough knowledge, enough research, and enough kind of clinical experience to differentiate and actually make some sort of demarcation between a subgroup of people who may have a disordered level of difficulty with regulating sexual behavior for a variety of reasons. And it's a clinically distinct condition from all the other ways we know human behavior can be dysregulated because of psychiatric disorders. I don't think we have the science or the understanding of that at this point. And so the other concern is what Michael and I call is premature evaluation, where professionals move very quickly to a disease conceptualization or establishing a disease to understand the sexual behavior concern. And our model really looks from a perspective of sexual worries and sexual problems and sexual disorders. We think the vast majority of people who are currently presenting in mental health clinics or wherever for their concerns about their sexual behavior really are having a problem with their sexual behavior that's in the range of normal range of human sexual behavior, although on the far end of the bell curve, but doesn't necessarily mean it's a pathology or a disorder. And I think way too many people are being encouraged to think of their problem as a disorder rather than it's just a human behavior problem.
Mm-hmm. And I would add is like sometimes those labels can conceal more than they reveal. We hope to help create a process where people can remain curious about the underlying factors that are contributing to this sexual behavior problem. So if we introduce a phrase like sex addiction or compulsivity, we are potentially closing down that curiosity because we're saying, oh, it's this disease model, or oh, it's a symptom of anxiety, which is, you know, what a compulsion is. So we wanted to create a protocol that was comprehensive in the variety of ways in which sexual behaviors can be problematic. And that might be related, for instance, to an established clinical disorder, like it's a symptom of major depressive disorder or undertreated bipolar disorder. We want to be able to create that space of curiosity so we can identify all those potential factors and not rely on one singular explanation of what's going on.
Yeah, and the only thing I would add to that as far as my own experience, I went to the presentation in Minnesota of Eli Coleman, who's, I think, more working under this impulsivity-compulsivity model of behavior. My concern that came up right away as I was listening to, again, the diagnostic criteria, as you're talking, Doug, that there might be some type of line drawn where now it does become a concern or a diagnosable thing, is that, again, it seemed very subjective. And looking at it through the lens of somebody self-diagnosing through the criteria that that can be put up on a DSM webpage or something, I was very concerned that those, the way that those things were described, both from a professional standpoint and from the public, that again, the variety of sexual problems or conceptions about one's own problematic behavior could be very easily self-diagnosed.
And I appreciate you saying that because I think the allure of a disorder is profound. If you have a behavior that can be the source of such moral judgment, such betrayal and hurt in important relationships, can be stigmatized as disgusting and vulgar because of the kinds of behaviors that are being engaged in, can be deemed morally reprehensible by many people. That kind of tribal rejection is so incredibly painful, and for some people, potentially feeling as if they'll be annihilated from, you know, all attachments. The ability to have a disease to maintain those attachments is an incredibly useful tool. So the allure of a disorder rescues people from those repercussions that can be even more devastating than just the consequences of having out of control sexual behavior. So I think we have to look at the cultural context in which disease kind of saves people from some of the most painful social behavior human beings do to each other when they reject each other.
You know, and I'm also sympathetic to kind of the pragmatics of diagnosable conditions in that it can allow someone to have access to services because then they have a billable diagnosis code that they can then can submit to their insurance, or you have a standardized criteria in which, you know, science can then research what's happening. So I am sympathetic to those concerns. But I also wonder, is then the problem not just, you know, the absence of a disorder for diagnosis, but how we can sometimes restrict access to care for people to have sexual health conversations with an informed and respectful provider that doesn't have to fit through that medical model. So I think another hope that Doug and I have with this book is to be able to expand access to care with a competent and respectful and safe clinician that doesn't necessarily have to rely on a disorder. something else that we like to say is like, you don't necessarily need a disorder for someone to change their behavior. The client just needs motivation, and then we can work with them to promote sexual health and sexual responsibility. So I'm sympathetic to those concerns, but I'm hoping to be able to access, to expand access to care, rather than just kind of having to have everything bottlenecked through that medical model.
So let's get right into then this title, Out of Control Sexual Behavior. How do you define that? How did you come up with that term? This is probably the one area where you both know I gave you a little bit of a hard time with this name, mm-hmm. but I don't know what name there is that somebody wouldn't give a hard time about. So, because again, it's so subjective as far as how we all look at this. Mm-hmm. We know through obviously the work that I do with many religiously conservative clients as to some of the work you're talking about with maybe people having sex in public spaces anonymously and several times a day, that sexual behavior varies tremendously. And, you know, it's very typical for me, for example, to have a young man in my office who feels like masturbating once a month is out of control. And you have mm-hmm. people who are having sex with prostitutes on a regular basis or sex workers, and then basically saying that feels out of control. So yeah, let's mm-hmm. get into kind of how do we even begin to talk about behavior on such a large spectrum.
Well, Michael and I, in writing our book and really outlining our model, did need to define our language of mm-hmm. out of control sexual behavior, and we went first to the sex research and found articles by John Bancroft, a very esteemed sexologist, former director of the Kinsey Institute, who wrote articles and did some research. And he recommended, because of the lack of clarity and really consensus in the profession about how to understand and really label this behavior, that he promoted in a paper in 2004 that until we have a better understanding of whether or not this is actually a pathology state or just a spectrum of human behavior that's on the far end, but nonetheless part of human behavior that's not a form of pathology, he recommended using the phrase out of control until we had better clinical distinctions about that understanding. And that, and when Michael and I read his article, we thought that was a good compromise given all of the competing dilemmas with trying to understand this without having too many pejorative or judgmental presumptions just by trying to give it a name. So that was the best, and we stuck by it since then. And so we do use the term out of control sexual behavior, and we define it as an individual's consensual sexual urges, thoughts, or behaviors feel out of control to the person.
Yeah, to add to that, if you don't mind, was what you were talking about, Natasha, is that it is a subjective experience. This is not something that we are diagnosing that the client is having, but they are coming to us using some type of language or even a metaphor of an addiction or compulsion to communicate something to us. And how we understand that is that they are telling us subjectively, this feels out of control to them. So we feel like our definition pivots on that word, you know, where their sexual or urges, thoughts, and behaviors feel out of control. And so we want to have a conversation around, all right, if this feels out of control to you, let's learn more about this. How does this feel out of control for you? What are you trying to navigate where this sexual expression is the result? So you even just talked about some particular examples where it's not about frequency of behavior. It's not even about the content of the behavior. It's more about how they subjectively feel in the moment.
Or they're conflicted about the behavior. Mm-hmm. They have a conflict with their behavior. And oftentimes people don't know how to say, I'm conflicted about my sexual life, or I have a conflict that my sexual behavior is not congruent with my values. You know, the consumer just doesn't walk in and say these things. And so we actually have very poor language to help people describe these things. So they end up coming in and using the language that we've given them. And the language we've given them is sex addiction. You know, so it's a large, large basket when somebody walks in and says, I have a sex addiction. And so, you know, the work is to help the client identify what exactly is their conflicts with their behavior.
I agree, Fish. I think there are some limitations to this phrase. And Ricky Siegel, a sex educator and therapist, gives his joke to kind of zero in on this, where he talks about how a patient's in the doctor's office and the doctor tells the patient, you have to stop masturbating. And the patient asks, why? And he's like, so I can examine you. So it illustrates that just because someone feels out of control doesn't mean they actually are out of control. There are definitely times where the patient is directing their behavior, they're making sexual choices, they're not masturbating perpetually, consistently, all the time. They're not always having sex whenever the opportunity arises. So there is a degree of self-regulation that is going on. And those are the moments we also want to get curious about, because there are the moments of success or resilience that we want to get curious about so we can potentially grow from and learn from. So yeah, I appreciate that when people hear that, it's like, oh God, that can even sound potentially judgmental, that we're saying, oh, you're being out of control. That's not how we use the phrase. We just use it as a way to help us understand that they're communicating to us that they feel out of control at some time, and we want to know more about it.
And I think this is so pivotal for the public to understand this, because if somebody just kind of peruses through the library and sees your title, you know, it's very easy to then say, aha, mm-hmm. See, there is out of control sexual behavior, and I'm maybe the angry wife, you know, and so see, you need to go take care of your out of control sexual behavior, you're out of control, right? And so mm-hmm. I think that's probably my main concern with it. But at the same time, what you're saying is that so much of this is our own angst around our sexuality. There's so many different messages that many of us grow up with, whether it's through religion or culture or family or whatever, you know, the many, many things that affect us with our sexuality. And so there is usually some level of conflict within us. What I also find interesting about what you said at the conference I attended is that you want to make sure that you, well, that I guess us as clinicians understand that most of this model is based on your work with men. So can you talk a little bit about why it is that you're not treating women?
Natasha, before we do that, and I do want to answer your question, I really want to clarify and really highlight something you just said that I think is another mm-hmm. really salient point for our model. And that's that you described this, what I'm going to call a jumping to conclusion. Whatever the name is, a person in pain or who's been hurt or is scared will look at that name as a way to organize their experience in understanding somebody who's injured them. Oh, see, your sexual behavior is out of control. And it's used as a way to help somebody who's scared and nervous. Now, we can't control that. I mean, you know, somebody has an ache in their stomach and they think they have cancer. I mean, it happens. What our model does, and it's our ethical stance, is our model says it is the purpose of our pathway model to have an ethical standard that the first thing we're trying to do is to protect the client from us. The client can make whatever assumption they want, but when they walk into a professional office, our ethical stance is we have to protect the client from us doing the same erroneous thinking that the consumer brings into our office. So we have to not go into a premature evaluation. We have to stop ourselves from using language that prematurely organizes an experience with a label that's maybe completely inaccurate. That's on us as professionals. The public can use whatever language they need to help themselves understand their experience. But once they walk into our office, then the language has to be accountable to a rigorous and clear understanding of what exactly the person's behavior is.
Love it. Yeah, absolutely.
So I just needed to say that before we went beyond that, because I think your critique of the name is very accurate. I mean, any name can be used as a kind of an allegation mm-hmm. very quickly and prematurely by somebody who's been hurt, injured, scared, or is disgusted by somebody's sexual behavior.
Yeah, and you can see my own biases, right, coming through. mm-hmm. Because that's a lot of what I deal with, of course, from the perspective of where I work from. Okay, sure. So let's get into this idea of why it is that mainly this is a model that you've used with men, because from what I remember you saying at the conference, there just really aren't women walking in saying they have out of control sexual behavior.
Well, the reason women aren't walking in saying they have out of control sexual behavior is because we say we don't work with women. They're going to some other door. They're just not coming to ours. You know, I started working with men years ago, and when there was the possibility of expanding my clinical work to women, I was a one-man show, and I did not have the ability or time to do the due diligence about education and training and expanding my professional knowledge to also do the kind of quality and ethically standardized work with women that I was developing with men. It was too much for me to take on, and I had too much respect for the necessity of not repeating some of the things that happened earlier around gender differences in treatment, where we made assumptions that things were or were not applicable and easily transferable across gender. And I just had too much respect for the errors of sex therapists in the past doing that. And I just made a decision that I wasn't going to be the person to do that, but I would remain developing my expertise and working with men. And when Michael came on board, that was a decision we both agreed to stay with. So it's not that we have not been open to the idea. It's just that there's only so much we can do. And that was a limitation we chose to make on our clinical work.
So some questions I would just ask for you to address. Do you feel that this model then is applicable to therapists working with women? That would be one question. And then secondly, what if any of this also has to do with the possibility that we as a culture don't usually treat women's sexuality as out of control? In other words, if a woman is acting sexually in ways that seem hot or seem like, wow, you're lucky, right? Because she's got a high libido or she wants to have sex so many times. And so that's, in a sense, seen as something amazing or wonderful. Or even women who feel dysregulated feel some sort of shame because we don't talk about women in that regard. And so therefore, there must be really something wrong with me if really it's only men who deal with this and somehow I'm in that loop. So anything that you could talk to those issues.
Well, I think when this comes up in presentations, we also want to inspire other clinicians to take this on. I mean, we moved into working with male sexuality as a choice because we saw the need and we want to address it. And there is definitely a need to work with women's sexuality. So we want to inspire other clinicians to be able to do that. We just knew our limitations and that it's okay that that's not us. But we want people to take some of the ideas from our book and see what they can do and apply that to women's sexuality. So I want to encourage your listeners that if this is an interest of someone who is in the field, please take that on. I mean, I think that's just a choice of specialization that is needed.
I think we haven't spoken a great deal about our model, but the area of our model that I think would be most pertinent to being really carefully addressed in working with a cisgender female would be around the areas of our model that deal with erotic conflicts. In other words, that the client has one of the factors that makes them feel like their sexual behavior is out of control is there's an aspect of their erotic desires, their sexual behavior, how they're conducting their sexual life, that is a conflict with either their values or other aspects, maybe the agreements they've made in their relationships, whatever. And the social and cultural context of a woman is going to be different in those conflicts than the social and cultural conflicts for men. And so for a woman to say, I have an erotic conflict would need to be clearly understood that conflict comes from that woman's own sense of herself and who she wants to be as a sexual human being, rather than that conflict comes from only trying to comply with somebody else's agenda who they think a woman is supposed to be sexually in our culture. That a woman has just as much right to her own autonomy and integrity as an erotic and sexual human being. But she may have conflicts about who she is, or somebody else might have a conflict with what her desires are. But how those conflicts are addressed in our society, I think, are quite different in the life of a woman, a cisgendered woman, than the life of a cisgendered man.
And I would also add that the sexual health principles that we talk about in the book are very applicable to women. To remind the audience or to people who haven't seen the book, there's six principles that are derived from the World Health Organization's working definition of sexual health. You know, it's a consensus from a public health and medical body that is trying to establish the parameters and understanding of sexual health. And those include sex being consensual, non-exploitive, protected from STIs and unwanted pregnancies, honest, mutual pleasure, and shared values.
And also protected from HIV.
Yes. So the idea is to help our clients to think critically about their sexual behavior. When they come into our audience, one of the first come into our office, one of the first questions we have is, what is your vision of sexual health? And a lot of times, you know, people just kind of stare blankly at us because they haven't really had a conversation about sexual health. They don't know what that phrase means. So it's an educational opportunity to talk about our sexual health approach. Then it becomes these principles that they can use to evaluate their behavior, to understand, is this something that I want in my life, or is this something I want to change or evaluate? So it moves away from some of the act-centered pitfalls that we see in other models where, you know, treatment is based on frequency of sexual behavior or the fact that behavior or interest is unconventional. We're more interested in this ethical approach around sexual health and helping people develop these type of sexual values and interests. And, you know, I think David Light talked about a phrase around sexual integrity. Mm-hmm. So in some of the kind of examples that you were talking about, I think women can benefit from that type of discussion. When we published this book, we kind of first had to build the floor of sexual health and talk about this in a general way before we got more specific in talking about out-of-control sexual behavior. So that foundation of sexual health, I think, is an invitation to the field as a whole to integrate that domain of sexual health into behavioral health care, regardless of the gender of their clients.
And regardless of whether the sexual behavior is out of control.
Yeah.
We believe that, you know, the principles of sexual health, which come from the definition of sexual health, really are standards that are applicable around maintaining one's sexual health, which is one of the basic elements of health and well-being. There's physical health, mental health, spiritual health, and sexual health. Those are the four pillars of health and well-being for human beings. And the way to establish a foundation for sexual health as a way to understand if somebody's maintaining their sexual health is to have the person evaluate, is my sexual life consensual, non-exploitive, protected from the things Michael spoke about? What is it have a degree of honesty? And is it congruent with my values in a sufficient way? And does it have the level of pleasure for myself and the people I'm having sex with? And that those are the fundamental standards. There's plenty more to talk about with sexual health. That's not all there is. But those are the fundamental criteria that have to be aligned before one can make more nuanced understandings of one's sexual health and sexual life.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly where I was going next, was these principles of sexual health. So I'm glad it just kind of naturally went there. So great.
Okay.
Because then I'd like to spend hopefully the rest of the time getting more in depth into the OCSB model. And maybe we can start off with what you would call the vulnerability factors that are part of, I believe, the assessment picture for you.
We are a kind of assessment-heavy approach. You know, it goes back to that conversation we were having earlier around wanting to create a space where we can comprehensively evaluate all the factors that can contribute to out-of-control sexual behavior. So the first step, and this is typically happens in our first appointment, in our consultation, where someone is coming to see a sex therapist, particularly for this behavioral conflict or this sexual problem. So we, in that first session, run through this checklist to see if some of these common vulnerability factors or particular clinical distinctions that we make are present, because that's going to help us determine the direction of treatment. So there, that checklist contains, you know, two clinical distinctions and four what we call vulnerability factors. So the first, you know, two clinical distinctions are around motivation for change. We want to know what they're motivated to change and why. because we don't work with people who are not interested in changing their behavior or it's coming from some other place. We need to find what their internal conflict is about it. And the next one is around consensual sex, because this approach is specifically for people concerned about consensual sexual behavior problems. Those engaged in non-consensual sex, we refer to non-consensual sexual specialists to address that. And then the four vulnerability factors that you talk about are things like physical safety. Are they experiencing some type of violence in their lives, like intimate partner violence? Are they involved in self-harming behaviors, having thoughts of suicide? Because that needs to be a priority to be able to address before we can address some of the sexual health problems. Physical health. Is there a medical condition that might be contributing to this issue? Is this a potential side effect of medication? What is their relationship with HIV if they're having a high rate of partner change? Things that we want to clarify before we move forward. Their mental health. Is there untreated or undertreated clinical disorder that might be contributing to this issue? I mentioned a couple before, like bipolar or depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress symptoms. And then the last one is relationship with drugs and alcohol. So we want to understand, you know, everyone has a relationship with drugs and alcohol, and we want to understand what that client is, and does that have an impact on their sexual health? So before we even get to some of the underlying clinical issues, we want to establish these conditions for good psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Can we just back up just really quickly and talk slightly about consent? Because you do talk about it in your healthy principles. You also talk about it in your assessment. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you're saying, you would refer maybe to a different treatment program if there was those issues. So can we just give a very basic overview of what the difference is between consensual and non-consensual sexual activity?
Well, even before we talk about what the difference is between consent and non-consent, from a kind of an assessment situation are, I think I'd like to go to conceptually. This is also where some of the models of treatment that are currently out, in the public, this is where we have a disagreement. In sex addiction treatment, oftentimes there is a combining of clients and patients, and I'm going to say men because most of the clients in sex addiction treatment are men, that they combine men who are involved in non-consensual behavior with men that are involved in consensual behavior. And even the distinction between what degree of non-consensual behavior is out of the purview of even sex addiction treatment isn't as well defined as I would like to see it. So it does a predatory sex offender, is that a good candidate for sex addiction treatment? Or is somebody who's just involved in coarse sexual behaviors, maybe they're involved in, inappropriate touch in the workplace or sexual harassment, or maybe they're, involved in watching or taking images of people or distributing nude images of somebody online without their consent, very coarse behaviors. This is all the spectrum of non-consent. And consensual behavior, though, really the primary demarcation is the person or the people, this man, is having sexual contact with, have all the people involved, are they capable of legally and, by age and other parameters, able to give consent for the sexual interaction that's happening?
Including inebriation.
Exactly right. So if somebody's having sex with somebody that's unconscious or somebody who's, incapable of giving consent because of the influence of drugs or alcohol that they're under, this is the responsibility of the other person who's not so impaired to assess the person's ability to give consent. That is the responsibility of the person, not just the person who's drunk or high, but it is the responsibility of the other adult in that sexual situation to assess, is this person capable of giving consent? And if they're not capable of giving consent, I do not have the permission to further engage in any sexual contact. So this idea of consent is a very vital one. And we think clinically, from a public health perspective, people involved in non-consensual offending behavior oftentimes have no access to therapy, no access to help until they've been arrested. that's pretty much the treatment standard in the United States, is men who are involved in these behaviors really don't appear for any kind of help until they've gone through some sort of arrest or legal process. And so what we're trying to do is, if somebody walks in our office and they're showing that they've been involved in non-consensual behavior, they're wanting treatment for sex addiction because that's what they'll call it, we believe from a public health perspective, we can help this man get to a specialist who's been highly trained in working with this population of non-consent before they get arrested and have other victims in the meantime. The devastation of being arrested for a sex offense is just beyond the pale in our country. Life is absolutely never the same after an arrest. And so if somebody can actually change this behavior or get help with this behavior or be assessed at how serious the behavior is before that devastation to their lives and their family, not even counting the victims that could be future be occurred, we believe this is a vital public health service. But that's the stance we take. It is not a stance taken by most of the other trainings that are done for this field, in particular the sex addiction field.
And I would add, it's then the clinician's responsibility to gather that information. So when clients come to us and are concerned about their sexual behavior, it's imperative that the clinician assesses for issues of non-consent. And that includes people who are engaged in partnered sex, but people who are concerned about solo sex or their masturbation patterns. So frequently people are concerned because they're watching sexual videos online. And this is where, when we talk about with sexual health conversations, details matter. So we need to know, what is it that you're looking at? Are you looking at videos that include people who are under the age of consent? Are they looking at videos where the person who's being depicted didn't consent to be there? So like a webcam in the bathroom, for instance. So we want to gather that information to know if they're in the right place. So if they disclose that they're engaging in some form of non-consensual sex, we usually talk to them about making certain that they're being seen by the appropriate specialist, have them determine if non-consensual sex is indeed present and a concern and warranting treatment. And if not, then potentially they then can come back to us for further assessment and treatment. But we feel that that would be the first step if they've disclosed some type of non-consensual sexual expression.
We took the long road home, turned minutes into miles. And as the evening traveled on, the sunset bathed your smile. We stopped beneath the desert stars, wrapped in each other's arms. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary truth.
It's been a long road here, a trail. Like lovers do. And if sometimes we fell apart, we always came back home. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary.
Some people say, love is blind and forever is too long. But I see your eyes in every sunrise. Can't imagine life alone. Won't you by my side till the day I die and into the beyond? It's as simple as our love is. That's how I wanna go. All wrapped up in the arms of are extraordinary. It's nothing ordinary love. Ordinary. No, it's extraordinary.